My name is Joe Bob. This is Daily Caller Live. We have an awesome guest for us today who I believe is on the front lines in the battle against the super hyper woke and CRT in the intellectual space. I don't know if I can call him a friend yet, but here is Dr. James Lindsay joining us today. James, how you doing?
I'm good. Thanks, man. Yeah, you can call me a friend. I like
Okay,
you.
Cool. Cool. I appreciate that. So just kind of set things up for the people who are viewing and may not know who you are. Can you kind of explain why you've become the, I don't know, the biggest demon for the super woke left, especially on Twitter? How did that happen?
Yeah. Well, I mean, on Twitter, I troll them all the time. So that's part of it. And I'm not afraid to troll, even though I'm a so-called intellectual, mm-hmm. you know? So you pretend that everybody's all serious and intellectual world, and I don't. I just have fun. I just want to say what I want to say it the way I want to say it, mess with people a little bit if they take themselves too seriously, etc. So there's that. But I mean, the magic behind how I've become kind of what I am in the anti-woke or whatever you want to call it space is this is going to blow your mind what I did. I read their stuff and I took it seriously. That's it. That's the whole recipe. I read their stuff and I believed them. When they say things like we need a revolution, I was like, wow, these people want to have a revolution. And It's, you know, it sounds like that's really intense intellectual work, but it turns out it's actually really easy. You read what they say and then you believe them. And then you tell people what they say and they don't believe you. So then you read to them what they say and you say, see, they actually said it. And then they have this response that's, they can't really mean that. And I'm like, no, the magic sauce here is called believing them. When they say we need a revolution, when they say that we need to make race consciousness center and everything, just believe them. And then you realize, oh, wow, this is really bad. Wow, this is like Marxism and racism mixed mm-hmm. together into one thing with the goal of overthrowing society. Why? So that people like them can be put in charge of a program that they want to call something racial equity that mm-hmm. is a grift for them.
So I think a lot of people have a pretty good understanding of what is encompassed in this now blanket term of CRT and kind of how it's bad for schools. To kind of get to the strategy of what you were talking about, I'm assuming you're familiar with the Cloward-Piven strategy, which is, in my view, make things so chaotic and so bad that you have to start over. How is that actually the plan for the super wokes, and especially in the intellectual space, or is that kind of how they call it, just right-wing talking points?
Both, I think, actually. Okay. So I do think that that's part of the strategy. The woke, mm-hmm. I don't think, the woke themselves, you have to understand that there are two entities, sort of, they're really more than two, but we're going to focus on two entities that are kind of getting branded as woke with this kind of mm-hmm. broad brush term. And some of these people are actually woke in the sense that they are this kind of new derived form of Marxist. And sure, chaos benefits them, but they actually have an agenda, which is basically to empower themselves. And what the strategy is, if it's critical race theory, is that you're going to call everything racist until it's under your control. And if mm-hmm. it's feminism, you're going to call everything sexist and patriarchal until it's under your control. And mm-hmm. if it's this kind of queer theory stuff, you're going to call everything cis heteronormative and everybody's transphobic and homophobic and heteronormative, et cetera, until it's under your control. And so they have a very deliberate program that is not necessarily inducing chaos. It's to call everything by these names until they control mm-hmm. it. Now, on the other hand, there are these other people who primarily write the checks to the woke people. And they are big institution types. They are at the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. They're at the World Economic Forum. They're at the Open Society Foundation, at the Rockefeller Foundation, at the Tides Foundation, at the Ford Foundation, all these huge foundations. Those people understand that if they create societal chaos, then, and that's the strategy you're talking about, they understand that in that space of societal chaos, there are lots of opportunities. For example, they can put out the old political canard. Here's a problem. We have to do something about it. This is something. Let's do that. You know, and so they move their agenda into that space. But it's also, as you were describing, their strategy is that they can capitalize in various ways upon the chaos that they're generating. But the actual people who are woke in the sense of actually having a woke consciousness, as you might call it, who aren't just using woke as a tool for their agenda. Mm-hmm. They actually have a different program entirely. Their goal is not to create chaos. It's to create what they believe is change. The thing mm-hmm. Is that their theory is absolutely self-contradictory and inconsistent. And so chaos follows in its wake, but their goal isn't actually to create chaos. It's to create control for themselves.
Interesting. So when we first met, you told me that I needed to watch your speech at the TPUSA America Fest because I believe it was a direct quote from you. I burned the house down with how good it was. And I did watch that. And you and Charlie were talking about queer theory, which was kind of foreign to me. Can you kind of explain what queer theory is and how it's being used? I also believe you described it as the gateway to hell. So maybe you can get there in your answer.
I did describe it as the gateway to hell. Queer theory is a very bizarre branch of Marxist theory. It derives kind of from feminism, or it's mm-hmm. taken off from Marxist feminism. So the feminists wanted to give this idea that what makes male and female or man and woman what they are is the social construction of gender. So mm-hmm. there are these roles attached to being male and female called sex mm-hmm. roles, and they're imposed by the social structure. That means it's a Marxist type analysis, and that social construction of gender can be taken apart. So there, you can have, if a guy wants to be effeminate, there's nothing wrong with that. And if a woman wants to be a tomboy or masculine or whatever, there's nothing wrong with that. And it doesn't change their essential maleness or femaleness or whatever. Mm-hmm. And so you can kind of see that they're coming at it from this angle. We shouldn't prescribe roles for men and prescribe roles for women, even if in reality they are statistically strongly correlated, but that doesn't mean ironclad. The queer theorists go a step further and they're like, no, the whole thing, sex too,
all of it,
is all socially constructed.
Yeah.
It's none of it's real. And basically your sex, your gender, your entire identity in terms of sex, gender, and sexuality is up for grabs. They also actually do another one people don't talk about, which is romantic orientation, mm-hmm. Believe it or not. So there's like these four dimensions. How do you, male or female, what is your sex? How does their sex present? What is your gender? And then you have these two other categories. What is your sexual relationship to other people? And what is your romantic attraction to other people? Mm-hmm. And all of that for the queer theorist is up for grabs. Your identity is an identity without an essence for queer theory. That's what queer means, is an identity that has no essential qualities whatsoever. It's totally fluid. It can totally move around. And so their target is anything that's considered normal is creating an oppressive structure. Mm-hmm. So it's normal for men to like women. It's normal for men to want to get jacked and do manly things. Like, I saw a video the other day that's on the internet. I was scrolling and it said, "This is the perfect video for every man in your life." And I kid you not, all it was a picture, or the video, the guy's foot reaches out to a rock on a hill and he pushes the rock and the rock rolls down the hill. That's it. And I watched the whole video and I was like, and no woman would understand why anybody, very few women would understand why any man would just want to watch a rock roll down a hill.
Peak masculinity.
It's something weird about masculinity. And so what they would argue though, is that considering that normal for men is actually oppressive. The idea that there's any normal behavior for men, normal behavior for women, normal masculine behavior, normal feminine behavior, normal sexual behavior, including not having sex with children, that there's any range of normal is actually an oppression, a form of oppression for them. And so they want to break it apart. And so now you can start to see, I said it's the gateway to hell, but you can start to see how it's the gateway to hell, because if there's nothing that's considered normal and you're literally in anything goes, you're really in a state of complete chaos. But what I meant on stage at TPUSA when I said it's opening the gates to hell is that they're actually applying this to children.
Okay. So I think that actually perfectly leads us into the next thing I wanted to talk about. This idea of social emotional learning, the SEL, I guess it's the acronym that's used for it. Is it pushing its way into that? And is that kind of the new undercover way of pushing this stuff into kids' minds via the government schools?
Yes. So social emotional learning. And I have to hesitate a moment as I answer that about what it is. Because I've heard two accounts of where it came from, and I don't know which one is valid yet.
Okay.
But I'm going to take the more charitable account. And the more charitable account is that it arose from psychologists looking at kids who are struggling in schools.
Okay.
Kids that have trouble at home, kids who are flipping out about the lessons, they're not comfortable with the social environment, whatever it is. They have mm-hmm. what we used to call back in the day, troubled kids, for whatever reason, they have problems. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. so, you know, there's the counseling center at the school, you know, sometimes it's in-house, sometimes it's like separate, but you would take these kids that were having problems that were interrupting their learning, whether it's, mm-hmm. like I said, issues at home, issues with the material, issues with other kids, can't get along. And social emotional learning, from what I understand, was developed in order to intervene with those kids to teach them how to interact with their own social environment and the emotions mm-hmm. that they're experiencing so that they can kind of get those under control and improve their learning circumstances in school.
Which seems fine.
Not only is it fine, it worked.
Yeah.
It worked really yeah. well. Now, totally. What happened was this got colonized by the Marxists, who rebranded it as transformative SEL. Mm. And by the way, transformative is almost always a dead giveaway word that you're dealing with Marxists. So transformative SEL has this idea that you're now going to transform the individual children, but it's not even done the way that I just described. You are no longer identifying the troubled kids. You're saying if this is good for the troubled kids, it's good for all the kids. And if there are these oppressive power structures, then all the kids in some sense are troubled. So now it's getting applied by teachers who are not psychologists in classrooms, which are not therapeutic spaces, engaging in basically group psychology techniques and other psychological breakdown techniques and even cult indoctrination techniques. Under the guise of creating a more emotionally literate or emotionally intelligent student body, because the assumption is, if we're going to be very charitable, is that if it works for some, it works for everybody. Now, what they've done is, in terms of understanding your social environment and understanding identity within social environment, is they brought in tools like critical race theory and queer theory. And, you know, maybe there's one kid in the class who's gay or whatever it happens to be. Well, now the whole class is going to get through, put through the entire queer theory rigmarole and the gender theory rigmarole. And maybe the secret is that lots of them are actually secretly gay and they can't come out because of the social and emotional experience that they're having at home. Maybe their parents wouldn't approve and they're afraid of that. And so you can see that there's this element where they use queer theory and gender theory to groom kids. And then the same thing is happening within race. You have to understand the social environment of structural racism, blah, blah, blah. So critical race theory and queer theory and, you know, even things like fat studies and disability studies are being shuttled in through the social emotional learning program, which uses psychology as a tool out of its context in uncontrolled settings by unqualified people to break kids down psychologically, to bring in these ideas, to get them to think about the world this way. And, I can even tell you it's a reproduction of what Mao Zedong did to create the Red Guard in China in the 1960s and 1970s in his schooling programs.
Have you ever asked, just curious, have you ever asked any Marxist CRT enthusiast what Mao did wrong, what they would have done better than Mao? Because clearly that didn't work out very well for him long-term in China. Yeah, I don't know. Have you ever asked anybody like, well, what did he do wrong and how are we fixing it? Because apparently what you're trying to do is remake Mao's Cultural Revolution, but a little bit different so that it works this time.
Well, yeah, I haven't actually asked any directly, but I've read quite a bit about where they invoke Mao. And you'll be surprised how many of them think that Mao more or less had it right, actually. Huh. They are quite positive about Mao and Mao's program. But the general answer to that, there are two ways that they can answer it, depending on how sophisticated they are. The low-level answer is that they depended too much, Mao still depended too much on bureaucracy and violence. And so the idea is that you shouldn't, if it's going to work this time, you shouldn't have to use any of those. In other words, you're just going to use coercion and everything's supposed to be spontaneous through like group setting SEL kumbaya classroom that's going to just induce the critical consciousness in all the children and it's going to just happen from the ground up. So instead of it being top down, it should be bottom up. That's the less sophisticated answer. The more sophisticated answer would be based in the same concept that, you know, Mao used some of the wrong techniques. He relied too heavily on top-down force. He relied too heavily on violence. Mm-hmm. But also that he got co-opted by his own desire for power. Mm-hmm. And so that this idea that capitalism or whatever it is always creeps back in and co-opts socialism is this kind of core element of belief within their it's never been tried mentality.
Yeah. In the way that critical theory and critical race theory is actually being implemented into schools, it seems like it's an attempt to push out meritocracy in favor of other things that could get people to, quote unquote, the top. In that regard, can you, what is the right amount of meritocracy? Is it 100% meritocracy? Is it some mix? And how would you see that in the schools nowadays, especially, you know, when we do, when maybe we should try and get people on a better starting block. Obviously, you can't end in the whole equitable thing down the road. But in the attempt to get people at the same starting block, is 100% meritocracy the correct way of doing things? Or what are your take on that?
So I'm going to answer with a little bit of a deflection, just to be completely honest, because I don't know what the right answer in terms of number is. I would actually, personally, just to be forthright, I would tend toward 100%, to be honest with you.
Okay.
And so I want to say what Jordan Peterson said about this, which is that competence. So Jordan Peterson, let me give his whole argument correctly. There's always going to be hierarchy. There are always going to be winners and losers to some degree. And that's going to order and structure society. And what Jordan Peterson says is there's always going to be hierarchy. And the least corrupt form of hierarchy is one that's based on competence, thus meritocracy.
Gotcha.
Okay, so in that regard, the most possible is the way to go. The problem when you try to step in and say, well, we've got to correct for these differences in starting places is, first of all, the categories that you're going to use, like race, are low-resolution categories.
Yes.
So, you know, you're going to have some kids of whatever race, and I'm not even going to have, I don't have to name any particular races at all, that are going to be in better or worse shape relative to their race. And in fact, if you look, for example, at the statistics, I think we just saw recently that Asian women have now surpassed white men in terms of educational outcomes, attainment, and earnings in the United States on average. So it's like you're going to have people who are coming from different backgrounds. So race is the wrong variable for is what I'm really trying to get to.
Yeah.
So you're going to have this low resolution approach to solving the problem, which therefore is going to create ancillary problems. But you have other issues as well. But like when you try to force these things, you know, change the starting block, you have the tendency. If you've ever dealt with somebody who's like an addict or has a problem, there's a difference between, you know, helping them get where they need to get and enabling them in their problem. And that's what usually gets called the soft bigotry of low expectations. And so you're not actually helping people by enabling them to stay incompetent by getting rid of the idea of meritocracy. But if you don't mind me going off here half a second longer,
go for it.
Let me tell you what meritocracy is from a Marxist perspective, because all of this is rooted in Marxism. So Marx had this view that society is stratified into oppressors and oppressed. And I'm not, he did it via economic class and capitalism, but we don't have to do it that way. It could be with race, it could be with sex, it could be with whatever. So the fundamental heart of Marxism is that the society is stratified into an elite upper class and a oppressed lower class. And the upper class is oppressing the lower class, even if they don't mean to be, by upholding the social structure as it is. The way that Marx believed that the social structure gets upheld by that upper class, who he said work within the superstructure of society, is by something he termed ideology. An ideology is the set of justifications that they give for why they're in their superior position. So the capitalists are saying, well, I have more merit. I worked harder. I produced a better product. And so meritocracy is an ideological argument, according to Marxism, that allows people who are unjustly at the top of society to stay there and people who are unjustly at the bottom of society to say, well, if I would have worked harder, if I would have got a better education, if I would have tried, you know, whatever, and to accept their oppression. And so this is the way that Marx sees this, is that this is actually a mythology created by people in power to maintain their power. That's what an ideology is.
Is there, in that vein, is there a difference between ideology and values?
So most of the values, according to Marx, that are not Marxism, would be false values that are spun into this kind of web of mythology within the ideology. Okay. So you could say that the values, like punctuality, you know, determination, indomitable spirit, whatever these different things might be, that those particular values are part of this big, huge mythology, the ideology that the bourgeois have woven for themselves to justify their dominance of the people that they're oppressing. So what you see, by the way, in critical race theory, then, is white supremacy is the ideology that justifies why all the racial minorities, so to speak, are to be held down, and white people are supposed to be at the top of society, according to what critical race theory sees as the stratification there. So you see that that's just a perfect reproduction of Marx's view of ideology, where now it's no longer bourgeois values, meritocracy, etc. It's now rooted in the white supremacy. And so white supremacy is, meritocracy is seen as part of white supremacy. It's something white people tell themselves for why they deserve the good jobs, why they deserve the managerial roles, why they deserve to be able to set the trends for culture and society, etc.
So I'm curious in your thoughts of, so the formation of intellectual critical race theory starts in what, the 50s, 60s, or is that a little early?
Yeah, it's a little early. Okay. Critical race theory, kind of the considered, it depends on what you really want to say. They track back and say that in 1903, just to be completely clear about this, a book called The Souls of Black Folk by W.E.B. Du Bois was written. Okay. And they say that that book basically kind of is, in a sense, the first critical race theory book without being critical race theory. But the one that's kind of marked as the landmark book in critical race theory was published by Derrick Bell, who's considered the founder of critical race theory, in 1970. Yep. And that book in 1970 was called Race, Racism, and American Law.
So in that time period, it's hard to avoid the facts that the FBI was looking hardcore into a lot of prominent black figures, things like COINTELPRO with J. Edgar Hoover at the FBI, tapping Martin Luther King's phones, looking into Malcolm X, all of the other crazy things that they did. Now, if I were to go on a deep dive of J. Edgar Hoover, not going to assume his intentions, but it seems like he was more after communism than black people. And several of the Black Panther leaders spoke out fondly against communism. Is there a chance that Derrick Bell possibly, and again, this would have to assume the intentions of J. Edgar Hoover was to get communism, and communism happened to be espoused by black people. Is there a chance that the initial thought of critical race theory was misplaced, given the fact, if we're assuming that black people were being investigated, but not because they were black, because they were fond of communism?
Yes. Does that make sense? Actually, in fact, so when we read from another critical race theorist, and this is from a paper from 1995, the woman's name is Gloria Ladson Billings. She's a huge education advocate right now. Mm-hmm. She's doing a lot of work throughout the country, particularly, I know a lot of what she's done in Virginia, but it's throughout the rest of the country as well. She wrote in 1995 a paper called Toward a Critical Race Theory of Education. And I swear this isn't a weird tangent off of Derrick Bell. And in that paper, she says that the point of critical race theory, and I quote, is to make race the central construct for understanding inequality. So that's the mentality of critical race theory. So when you have somebody like Derrick Bell, who's taken this mindset up, that race is the central construct for understanding inequality, and he looks at something like what would have been going on with, say, J. Edgar Hoover in this case, and that there is maybe some other variable, such as communism or radicalism.
Could have been many other variables, yeah.
Militantism or whatever, that he... and could racism even be one of the variables?
Totally,
sure.
Totally
possible. But that there are a suite of other variables, and then it's been collapsed down into race has to be the central construct for understanding all of what happened. So what you actually have is a collapsing of something that may include racism or may not, that was very complicated and definitely included other variables like communism, radicalism, etc., militantism. Like the Black Panthers were a destabilizing and potentially dangerous force. If you had the government functioning correctly, because they were an extremist group, you would have them being looked at, right? Regardless of who they had, like the Black Panthers could have been just a funny name for a bunch of white guys, and you still should, like, it could have been a MAGA or whatever.
They should
have been being looked at. And so, because they were being militants. And so you have all these other variables.
In the context of Vietnam, like we have the Red Scare going across the country. So in the context of things happening around the world, it wouldn't be out of the question to say, yeah, these guys are talking about how much they love communism. I forget the guy's name who was shot and killed in Chicago, I believe, leader of the Black Panther Party there, but was like on the record, like pro-communism. So
yeah,
sorry to cut you
off. No, you're right. And so what critical race theory does by design is take all those other possible variables and explanations and collapses them into its racism. Mm-hmm. And Derek Bell, not only did he do this in general, and so do all the critical race theorists thereafter, because they make race the central construct for understanding inequality. That's not difficult to understand what they're actually doing, collapsing every possible explanation into no, somehow it's race and we're going to figure out how. But Derek Bell had a weird soft spot for communism specifically as well and was trying to protect it. How do I know that? Well, you read his analysis of one of his favorite things to bring up. It's kind of the birthplace of the critical race analysis in law, is Derek Bell's take on the Brown versus Board of Education decision in 1954, I think. And so Brown versus Board of Education is the one that desegregated schools.
Yep.
And so there are a lot of things that Derek Bell said analyzing this. And one of the more important ones is where he came up with what he called his interest convergence thesis, which says that white people only help black people when it's in the white people's interests too. Mm-hmm. So it's always got a cynical motivation, or else black people just get, you know, their interests have to converge. That's why it's called the interest convergence thesis. And so when Derek Bell explains this, though, in the terms of Brown versus Board of Education, his explanation for it's very strange. What he says is that communists globally were promoting themselves through their propaganda as being anti-racist. It's workers of the world unite. The races don't matter. Blah, blah, blah. We are the fundamentally anti-racist ideology. And then they were pointing at the United States with their segregated schools and saying, look how racist free countries, so-called free countries are. We're not. Communism is better than freedom. And so that particular, the interest that converged, or one of the key points that, because Bell raised a few, but one of the key points that Bell raised as the interest that was being protected was that white people desegregated schools to beat communist propaganda because they didn't want communism to spread. And so Derek Bell's whole analysis has a deep, maybe it's not the only root, I don't want to be too reductionist like he is, but has a deep root stuck in protecting communism and the spread of communism. And saying that the real motivation for desegregating schools was so that we could fight global communism, which presumably shouldn't really be fought.
Interesting, huh? I know we're running a little bit long, but I gotta ask you about the word of the day and your thoughts on mass formation psychosis. That was a big word that got what did Robert Malone said it on Joe Rogan's podcast? What do you think about that? Just in terms, is that a term you had heard before the last couple of weeks? Again, in the intellectual world.
I don't think I had heard that. I had actually heard of mass psychosis before. I used to study the psychology of religion, and there's all these events where, you know, I forget what the details of this one is, but this is a very famous example where allegedly a whole bunch of people went to this hill, like hundreds of people, and they claimed that like the Virgin Mary appeared in the sun or something like that. And like hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people claimed they all saw her, which I'm going to go ahead and do the doubt meme on that one, flashing all these colors, right? Uh-huh. But hundreds of people swore that they saw her. Then there's this other thing I know about that's called the nocebo effect. And there's the nocebo effect is the opposite of the placebo effect. So placebo, obviously, you take something like a sugar pill, it doesn't have any chemical effect on you, but you end up having, you know, you feel like, oh, I took something, so I feel better or whatever. The nocebo effect is the opposite. It's where you're given nothing and you manifest the side effects of having taken it. So there's an example. This actually happened in a school, and I don't remember when, but somebody in a chemistry class claimed that they could smell gas and they were having these weird symptoms, right? And then everybody in the class started to feel sick, and then the teacher started to feel sick, and then the next thing, you know, all these different people throughout the whole school started to feel sick. They send everybody home. They send hundreds of kids go to the hospital, not just with subjective symptoms like I don't feel well, but they have nausea, they have rashes breaking out and everything. And meanwhile, they send in, you know, chemical teams or whatever, hazmat suits, I don't know, somebody, OSHA, somebody's going to the school, and there's nothing. There's absolutely nothing. So this person starts having some kind of a weird attack or whatever, allergy or something flares up, and social contagion spread, and everybody in the, like hundreds of kids in the school all started to manifest even physical symptoms like rashes, which is totally, and it's classified. If you look up the nocebo effect, it's a classic example of the nocebo effect, which is placebo, but with no in front of it instead of pla. And so that would be an example. Both of those would be examples of what is being referred to as mass formation psychosis. This is a psychosomatic illness that didn't really exist, and it manifested in hundreds of kids. And so it's totally plausible. And in fact, the literature on this goes back to like the 1800, like 1850s or 60s or something. It's not like it's this new idea that Robert Malone just made up.
I know
that Reuters wants us to believe that, but that's not true. It is totally plausible that that you can get lots of people worked up, and whether through fear, whether through propaganda or whatever, believing something that's not true and being very caught up in the idea that it's key to their maybe social identity to believe that it's true. And as the nocebo effect shows us, even to the point where they manifest physical symptoms and they have all these issues coming up, to the point like where you think it's even beyond the capacity of a mental construction to do that to you. So, I do think that this is likely what has happened. I do think that this is a tool that is used in psychological operations through propaganda. Yeah. I think that this is exactly what our media and the politicians behind a lot of what's been going on with COVID did to our population on purpose, which is that there's a cycle. I mean, it's known. It's called fear cycling. It's known how it works, that you ramp up people's fear. This is, by the way, a cult indoctrination technique. You ramp up people's fear. In other words, you create vulnerability. And then you give them a partial out. You let them start to feel better, but usually by doing something that that increases their commitment to the cause. Wear a mask, get a vaccine, don't go out, you know, whatever it happens to be. Social distance, which is just some made up crap. Like all of these things. And you get people, oh, you have this thing you can do. And if we all pitch in together, all mass formation, as a matter of fact, then we can get out of this fear, this panic that we've hit. And then right when the people start to feel better, bam, you hit them with another dose of the fear, and you cycle it up and down and up and down and up. And this is a known psychological warfare technique. I appeared on the Tim Pool podcast, Timcast, about a year ago. And Tim was like, well, what are we going to talk about? And I was like, I want to talk about psychological warfare. I want to talk about, in fact, what did I say was the word political warfare? I said, which psychological warfare is part of political warfare. Mm-hmm. I said, it's the most important concept you've never heard of. Mm-hmm. This is what's happening. That was in February, early February of last year. It's like, this is what's actually being done to us on a massive scale by lots of actors using social media and mass media as the primary tools to do it. So I think it's preposterous to think that mass formations of people acting like lunatics and in service to some kind of a, you know, resolution of a fear that's been induced in them. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's ridiculous to think that that doesn't happen. We see it happening around us. We see it happening throughout history. Giving it a name doesn't change that fact. I guess, what is it, Matthias Desmet or something like that is the one who actually called it with this specific term, but the idea has been around for decades, if not centuries.
So we all talk about it in regards to COVID, but I'm curious, can that then be an explanation as to how critical race theory and equity have come to prominence?
Yeah. Absolutely. You know, George Floyd died. We all have to believe that this was this heinous murder instead of a arrest that went bad. For any number of reasons, which include fentanyl, not to exonerate he who has been found guilty by a jury, but nevertheless, and now we all have to have a racial reckoning, and racial reckoning is the most important thing in the universe, and we all have to put black squares on our Instagram or else you're a bad person. Absolutely. What is the other thing? Where do you see the largest increase in trans individuals? And this is how you get in trouble on YouTube, let me tell you what. It's in young women deciding that they're trans to the point where there's this whole thing that they call the social contagion hypothesis. That also is the same kind of a thing. But what's inducing that? Now we can circle back to the SEL that we talked about a minute ago, which will be fun because you have critical race theory telling all these poor little white girls that they have nothing but a negative identity.
Yeah.
But guess what? You have a positive identity over here if you just become
just do
non-binary
that.
Or trans or whatever else. And this, when I said that this is Maoist, that is the technique that Mao used in the schools. He created a suite of 10 different identities. Five of them were classified as black and bad. Five of them were classified as red for communism and good. Mm-hmm. And he would label kids, or have their teachers, I guess, label kids within black identities. Your parents are rich or whatever they happen to be, and they're going to get shame heaped upon them and embarrassment heaped upon them. But if you become a little Red Guard revolutionary, you can have a red identity, and you're going to be, we're going to treat you with pride, et cetera. And you can generate a mass formation that then becomes socially contagious among the peers. And you can generate an entire movement out of these kids, for example, in schools, or an entire trend toward what are the gender non-conforming and non-heterosexuality, whatever the suite of those alternative sexualities or other sexualities happen to be. Like, this is the explanation for so much of actually what's going on. And we're seeing it implied with deliberate psychological technique, both in schools and in the media, to create this so-called mass formation psychosis. And it's, yes, COVID, same. And what are we now using it to do? Mobilize hatred. It's falling apart, but we're mobilizing hatred against the so-called unvaccinated. And I hate to use the term unvaccinated. Yes. It's like as if being, having been injected with mRNA a couple of times is the default for humanity. No, I don't think so. So, you know, you can see this happening in all these places, but the same thing is occurring again and again. You generate vulnerability and you give people through the doctrine a resolution to that discomfort. Then you put them back into discomfort to strengthen it in a cyclical pattern. And eventually you get enough people where their social identities are tied up in that, that it becomes mass formation because it's what it means to be a good person in this society. I don't think that's actually a complicated idea, but yeah, it touches critical race theory is doing it, queer theory is doing it, the SEL in schools is doing it with those tools, and then you see it happening. We saw it in the media off of Black Lives Matter, et cetera, after George Floyd, peace be upon him, or whatever's death, and then now we have it also happening, or I saw had it happening all along with COVID-19. We had it happening with Trump. What do you think Trump derangement syndrome is?
Yeah, there you go. That's another great example. At the risk of going on way too long, I'm just curious. What do we do? What are the steps that everyday average people can take to fight back against all the craziness?
As far as like this aspect of mass formation psychosis, there are two primary steps that you can take. The first one, and I hate to put it this way, especially given the circumstances, turn your damn TV off.
Yeah.
The corporate press is trying to keep you in a fear cycle that will keep you feeling crazy. Mm-hmm. All you have to do is turn it off.
Good thing we're on the internet.
The other thing is, and luckily we just saw it. What was it, in Forbes or Fortune or one of these ones that starts with an F magazines just said, well, psychological operations are necessary and good, or whatever they said. You know, they just published that yesterday. So you should probably realize, even with social media and through mass media, there is a psychological operation trying to get you to conform in a certain way. And the thing is what that old saying is, once you see it, you can't unsee it. Mm-hmm. And so that actually is a way for you to get to put a hook in reality and to pull yourself out of this nonsense. So what everyday people can do is A, realize this is happening, and B, turn off your damn TV, turn CNN off. Don't even hate watch it. Stop. And I say CNN, but short of maybe a small handful of programs, you shouldn't be watching Fox. You shouldn't be watching any of the big corporate press, because they're all playing this game, partly because it drives profits. You don't even have to have them in some big conspiracy or whatever. You make crazy money if you keep people addicted to you to get the next hit of resolution to the fear that they're inducing. Yeah. Right. And so turn off your TV and realize this is happening. There's two things normal people can do. And you're going to just start to red pill automatically at that point. Now, and calm down also.
Yeah.
The mass formation psychosis falls apart when you're not being brainwashed into it. And this is also known, especially if you have a friends group that's diverse enough to where there are some people saying, well, I don't know about all this. And maybe it goes a little too far. So saying that is another thing normal people like you and I could do. Just say, well, you know, if you're in a group of people and some of them are totally blue pilled, all you have to do is, oh, I don't know about all this stuff. You don't have to go with some wacky World Economic Forum you know, great reset whole dialogue, you can just say some of this stuff seems a little extreme. I just feel like it's too extreme, and like, let that do its work, you know? So that's something people can do. And the other thing, of course, that I keep telling people, I guess it's becoming my de facto tagline, is sit strongly and tell the truth, which is really just stop going along with the lie. You know that there are a lot of these lies, like, oh, well, I'm just going to wear a mask so other people don't feel uncomfortable. No, screw other people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
No, it is not your responsibility to make other people feel uncomfortable, feel comfortable by doing something that has zero efficacy.
Yeah.
So it's not your responsibility to do that. Like, we see so much of this, and this kind of circles back to other things we're talking about, enablement and coddling. There's so much like we got here by coddling the feelings of the inconsolable, the people who, you know, everything is a catastrophe. Everything is an emergency. Doctor, don't weigh me. We saw that one in the news. Don't weigh me because I might feel bad, fat phobia, something.
Yeah. Well,
stop trying to protect. It's not your job to protect everybody else's feelings. Uh-huh. It's just not your job. And it is not your social responsibility. That is a lie that has been foisted upon us through being nice and being polite and being kind. You don't have to be an asshole. You don't have to be an intentional jerk, but it is not your responsibility to coddle everybody else's feelings. It's just not.
Yeah. So the two steps. Know that it's happening. Turn your damn TV off. Love it. Dude, that's thanks key. So much. Yeah, thanks. Thanks so much, man. I appreciate you taking the time. I know we went quite a bit over, but really loved all that sort of stuff. We'll have to have you back. I've got more questions, so we'll have to have you back at some point later on in the future.
Look forward to it, man.
Appreciate you, man. Thanks.
Yeah.